Now, even though we're in the middle of a digital publishing revolution that's turning the real into virtual, Nicholas Pounder and Rick Jacoski are two men buried in the world of rare books and book-related memorabilia. They both admit they're obsessed with secondhand shops in quiet country towns. Who knows what they might turn up there? A first edition, a lost manuscript, or even George Orwell's pen. Nicholas Pounder does use the virtual world, though. He runs his rare bookshop by internet and mail order in Sydney. American-born Rick Jacoski is based in London. He's a writer and a former English lecturer. In Sydney for the 2010 Sydney Writers' Festival, they offered this peek into the not-so-rarefied world of the antique bookseller. Nicholas Pounder begins with his story of how he succumbed to the lure of the old, odd, and rare book.
I made a false start under pressure. My parents decided to get me a trade, which is a very British thing to do. It's something I'm told you fall back on. But after an agonising beginning as an electrical fitter, one day I just stood up and cancelled my indentures, walked out and bought a Sydney Morning Herald. And there I found an advertisement for a bookshop assistant. But above it, it said, sensible girl required.
And you thought, just the job for me.
But I went and I talked myself into that job, and I've more or less been in the book trade ever since. All the while that I'm working my way up or out of the stockroom, because I didn't get to meet a customer for almost a year. I was just, dare I say it, cutting the price corners off English dust jackets. All the while I was still scouting books in the second-hand bookshops and buying them at the staff discount. So eventually, many years later, when the time came for me to get out of the selling of new books and into the selling of old books, I had the stock ready to go, which were my own books, which was a very complicated sort of a grieving to sort of take a lease on a shop, shelve it, put all of the things that you'd lived with in close proximity for a very long time and actually pencil a price into the front of each of them. It was a shocking transition, but gradually, day by day, I got used to it and decided that the way around it was to keep buying more books. But the only way to keep buying more books was to keep selling books. You dipped out of being an academic, which is probably a graver mistake than dipping out of being an electrical fitter, isn't it?
Oh, no, trust me. Anything that gets you out of academia is a good thing. But it was when I was at Oxford that I started actually running books. And unlike you, I've never worked for another bookseller or all that. I kind of taught myself things. It's been a feature of my life from the earliest days that whatever my income is, I spend 20% more than it. And therefore, the recurring problem is, where is it going to come from? So for some years when I was at Oxford and then in my early years lecturing in the English department at University of Warwick, some of it came from playing poker, which I was pretty good at an amateur level. And some of it came because I taught myself how to run and scout for rare books. And to do that, you have to make a lot of mistakes, as you know. But if you get a few of them right, it's good. You run around the bookshops. You try to find something which looks underpriced. And those days, there isn't that much information about prices. There's no internet or things. And then you sell it on to the trade. Well, that's very difficult because if you look at how the economics work, you have to buy at 25% of final value because the trade is going to double up. So suppose you have a £100 book at trade value. The trade is going to pay you £50 for it. So you have to buy it at £25 or £30 to make it make any sense, which is to say you have to find somebody making a pretty bad mistake.
It's the way it goes. But you were accumulating stock in the same fashion, weren't you?
The first really good stock I ever bought. And one of the things about any form of life or any profession is that underlying it, you'll find there's some kind of animating archetype. For doctors, it's search for cure. For lawyers, it's the search for justice, or at least it used to be. For university teachers, to educate. For dealers, for rare book dealers, for antique dealers, the animating archetype is the treasure hunt. It's what keeps us going. I remember having luncheon on Teeb with Graham Greene once, and we're sitting there talking about books and one thing and another. He looked at me with a kind of devotion and awe. It was quite unsettling. And he said, "Do you know, I envy you your life so much." And I said, "Gosh, you know, I sort of envy you yours. What is it?" And he said, "It's the treasure hunt. If I hadn't been a novelist, I would have been a rare book dealer. I love that." And the first time, and it's right around when Nick is starting, it's sometime in the late 60s, early 70s, and I'm a young lecturer at the University of Warwick. And I've been buying and selling a few books, but at a very low level. And I got a phone call one day from somebody I didn't know. And he said, "I'm an antique dealer, I live in the north of England, and I've just bought a big D.H. Lawrence collection, and I gather you collect D.H. Lawrence," which I did a bit in a kind of minor way. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, it's got two signed copies of Lady Chatterley's Lover. It's got the first edition of Women in Love. It's got a nice copy of The Rainbow. It's got Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd in a Dust Wrapper, blah, 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 blah. And I want £1,000 for it. Would you be in the market?" And I said, "Sure, I guess I would." He said, "Well, I want cash." And I didn't know anything. I'm an academic. I don't know anything about anything, right? So that he wants cash doesn't mean he's going to evade tax. It means he's going to rob me, right? So I got very, very anxious. And he said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll meet, could you do Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock? We'll both go into Birmingham Railway Station, and I'll meet you there under the big clock."
Sounds like a Graham Greene novel, isn't it?
"And bring the cash." Now, £1,000 in those days is a quarter of the value of my house. So it's probably £50,000. So I go down to the bank manager and I say, "Can I have £1,000 loan to buy some D.H. Lawrence first edition?" And he says, "How do I know they're worth £1,000? And I said, "Well, I wouldn't buy them otherwise, would I?" And he said, "Oh, I'm relieved to hear that. Thank you. Here's your £1,000. This clearly was in the olden days, right? And I get my £1,000, and I'm very anxious. So I have a young colleague called George O'Brien, who's a very fine writer, wrote The Village of Longing, now professor at Georgetown. And he's about 5'5" and portly and very diffident. And I bring him along as a bodyguard. So George and I get on this train, and we go to Birmingham with £1,000 burning a hole in my pocket. And I'm very anxious, and the guy comes over, and he has tweed and corduroy, and he looks like an antique dealer, and he shakes hands. He says, "Look, my car is right outside on a yellow line. The books are in the car. Let's go and have a coffee." So I go over to the car. There's the books. I say, "No, we can do the deal right here. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine." And he says, "It's a yellow line. There's the traffic warden. I'm going to get a ticket. Can you please get in the car?" And I said, "No, it's fine. We'll do it here." And George O'Brien says to me, "For God's sake, will you get in the damn car?" And I thought, he's my bodyguard. And he's sending me to my death with this guy. We get in the car. We drive off. This is treasure hunting, right? It's very exciting and scary. We drive off and we go through this really seedy part of Birmingham. And we turn and we park on this deserted sort of looking lot. And I turn to the left, and there it is. It's the incarnation of everything that I've been terrified about. And I turn to my left, and I look at it, and it's an Italian restaurant. And, of course, those of you who don't know it, the mafia launder a lot of money by buying D.H. Lawrence first edition. And the guy says, "They make really good cappuccinos. Shall we go and have a cappuccino? I said, "No. I'm allergic to cappuccino." He said, "Well, have a Coke, you know, it'll be fine." And George is saying, "Get in the thing and have a cappuccino." And I'm absolutely refused. It's terrifying how timid I am. And he takes out the D.H. Lawrence books, and they are exactly as they are, and I don't go anywhere near the mafioso hangout. And we do the deal, and I go back, and those books end up in catalog number one. And though I end up feeling humiliated at my own cowardice and timidity, I think I have two things here. One is, I have a terrific amount of D.H. Lawrence first editions, and the other is, I have a good story.
I think this thing of the treasure hunt is one whereby you have the sense that if you stop looking, you'll stop seeing. And it's murder when you're driving with family holidays, because if there's a sign somewhere that says books, you can hear the children groan behind you.
But didn't you used to have a thing that you could pay for a whole family holiday by scouting the local bookshops?
That's what I would tell them. You know,
absolutely.
But I think that the sense of imminent discovery, or just the proximity of the possibility of finding something that keeps you looking at every pile of books. I can remember once, when my Victoria Street shop was in its early days, being tipped off by a street person that there was a lot of books going to be in a sale at the Plunkett Street Public School. So I'd arrived down there, and it was a hot Saturday morning, and they started unloading the books, and I couldn't believe it. There were all of these sort of full calf quartos of Arabic lexicons, and there were just some extraordinary books, and I started taking off items of clothing and laying them over the top of them just to sort of establish my rightful ownership. And just at that moment, a lady puts up onto the trestle a painting. And, of course, the painting has this immediate spark of recognition for me, because there is the familiar drawing of the poet Arthur Rimbaud by Verlaine right in the middle of this painting. And it looks like it's a collage. So it's like playing Twister. I've got these piles of books and I'm trying to reach this painting, which is a literary painting, therefore it counts.
Right. And on the other hand, you need to smack the people who are trying to get to the books.
So, yeah, it's I can't remember what happened to the Arab lexicons. They were wonderful things that went to a bookshop in Ireland, as I recall, but the painting of Rimbaud was a mystery. I took it back to the shop, and it was such a fine thing that I thought I would just simply use it as a bit of decoration. It seemed to be a booky kind of thing to have up on the wall. And about once or twice a day, someone would say, "That's a very interesting painting, and who's that by?" I'd say, "I don't know. I should take it and get it examined. I think it's a collage." And one day, one Saturday afternoon, this fellow came in, and he said, an American, he said, "Would you mind if I had a closer look at the picture?" And I said, no, it's all right. And he took it down. And he said, turning it very carefully down on the counter, he reached into his trousers and he took out a pocket knife. And he said, "Could I take the back off?" And I said, "No." And he then produced a business card which had him identified as a curator from the Whitney in New York. So he took the back off, and there was this wonderful story written on the back of the painting. It was a painting. It was Trompe-l'Oeil. It was made to look like a collage. And it was titled The Anniversary of Verlaine. And it was a painting by one of Cocteau's set designers, whose name was Salvatore Palais. And he came to Australia on a boat, and he started painting. The back of the painting was a diary of when he started the work, which was leaving Genoa, and when he finished it, which was in Sydney. So I did some more research, and it turns out he had one exhibition in Sydney at the Prouds Gallery, and at the bottom, where the Prouds sticker is written next to it, "This painting shall always remain the property of the artist." Turns out he lived in a boarding house in Woolloomooloo, just a few feet from where the Plunkett Street Public School was. So this thing had lain undiscovered for so long, and the kind of electricity you have at the moment, and then subsequently as you do the research. And I think the research part of it is probably what occurred to me as a natural part of the direction I was taking at the point when, having established the Victoria Street shop in the early 80s, I think I started the business in 82 and I opened the shop in 84, there was a point where suddenly I was pricing books for more than they cost when they were new. And this sets off a strange reaction amongst your regular clientele, because that means you're no longer a second-hand bookshop. So then you separate the stock from those things which are worth more than they were when they were new, and those things which cost less than they are new, which are the second-hand sections. I was still of the belief at that point and up until that time that my shop would only have a book that was a good book, or a book that I considered worthy for its text. Then one day a young man came in, and he was known at that time as Dennis the Dealer. Dennis the Dealer was an improbably good-looking young man. He was like something from a Greek myth. And he'd been living as an Australian illegally in the United States for 5 years, basically in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And his livelihood, he explained to me with great kindness, was derived from buying and selling books. And he said to me, you've got to open another section of this shop or a shelf or start a catalogue of those things which are special and significant and tell people why they are special and significant. And then he hoisted his bag up onto the counter and he said, I'll show you some important and significant books. So at that point, my first contact with what we call a runner or a scout is the point at which I realised that sometimes books are worth more than when they were new. And with the literary inclinations I had, I naturally then started to write a catalogue and develop a stock which was not so much secondhand, but more so to be things which were either scarce, significant, or had a story that I could tell by way of a catalogue.
This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval, and you're hearing an edited version of a conversation between rare booksellers Rick Jacoski and Nicholas Pounder, recorded at this year's Sydney Writers Festival. Both Rick Jacoski and Nicholas Pounder have embraced the internet in their work. Nicholas doesn't even have a traditional shop front, but both have a fond recall of the old pre-computer days when book runners would scout out secondhand shops looking for bargains, which they would then sell on at a profit. With the advent of the internet, though, the work of book runners is more complicated.
There was a kind of romance about the business of book scouting, and both of us started scouting books. Nicholas was always very, very much better than I, which actually, are there any book scouts in Australia anymore?
The business of runners. Well, runners in Sydney were a familiar sight amongst the bookshops. I got to understand and know who they were just through being a shopper in secondhand bookshops. There would be a man with a large globite coming in, bearded and bespectacled, at the same time every afternoon and dragging that case up onto the counter. There'd be another man who always used cardboard boxes and travelled by public transport, another one who travelled only by taxi, another one who was very loud and eccentric and demanded retail prices. But these people had a place in the kind of food chain of the second-hand book business. But then I have to feel sorry for them, because gradually they would be arriving at their appointed times with their boxes and bags and putting the things on the counter, and you would be looking them up to see what they were worth.
Well, this is what happened to me. It's the internet is the key, because book runners and book scouts, like people who scout for objects all over the place. You ever read Larry McMurtry's Cadillac Jack? It's about a kind of scout. It's absolutely wonderful. They depend on having more information, on being knowledgeable, and more knowledgeable than the people from whom they buy. Therefore, the spread of knowledge is a very, very, it may be good for collectors, I'm not so sure it is, but it's certainly not good for book scouts. So I'm out scouting in a little country bookshop in some country which shall be nameless, and I go in and it's a sleepy little place and there's nothing there at all, but even I can notice that behind the guy who's kind of half asleep at the counter is a shelf of good books, and on that is a copy of The Confidential Agent, Graham Greene, 1939, in a kind of tired dust jacket, but never mind, it's the sort of book I deal in. So I say, can I see that book? And he doesn't really want to show it to me, but he shows it to me, and it has no price. And I say, how much is the price? And he says, hold on, mate, and he gets out the computer. And he goes into ABE Books, Confidential Agent, Dust Wrapper, 1939. And he said, there's only one on the net, and it's a guy in Boston. It's $2,000. You can have it for $1,800. And I said, the guy in Boston is my friend Peter Stern, who's the world's most expensive dealer. He has overheads that you couldn't even begin to contemplate. And his copy, aside from a small nick in the upper left-hand corner of the dust wrapper, is really beautiful. And yours is rather tired, and yours is a $700 book. I will give you $700 for it. Spend the $700 on $700 more worth of books. Then you can get $1,400 for those. Then you can buy more books. Then you get $2,800. That's how it works. You don't understand your place in the food chain.
But what's worse, Rick?
And he glared at me, and he said, I don't think we're going to do a lot of business, are we? And I said, I don't think you're going to sell that book. Shall I write you an email in 2 years and offer you $700 again for it? And 2 years later, it was still there. What's happened with the internet is it has distorted people's way of valuing stock. And the people it distorts most are private customers. Because private customers have a little collection. They go into Nicholas. They say, I have a copy of the first Raymond Chandler book. I see Peter Stern has one at $10,000. Can I have $10,000 for it? Say, well, there is a difference between wholesale and retail, first of all. But secondly, the reason the damn book is on the internet is because it hasn't sold. And it homogenizes prices.
But the worst thing, Rick, is the worst thing. I can remember being in a bookshop in New Zealand, and I'd seen some early James K. Baxter material. I took them to the counter, and I said, how much are these? And the drop sheet comes off of the computer. The computer's fired up, finds every copy of the James K. Baxter at the top end, and he swings the monitor around and shows me. I said, yes, they're my books.
What did he say?
I bought some. He reduced the prices because he understood that I needed a margin, but he demanded to see some proof of identity. No, but look, I think that often people challenge me on the price of something, and really it does come down to this. Inevitably, in the finite practical sense of the consideration, you're in business, so if you need to sell something, there is the likelihood of a deep discount if that person is serious and you're serious and there are contingencies at work. But basically, it's how much I like something, and I think one is inevitably defined by one's stock. So it's too easy to sell your best stock cheaply. It's better to have your best stock around you because they make you look better. And then you meet someone who shares your enthusiasm and you have a real transaction. You have the willing buyer and the willing seller.
It's really hard also to replace good stock. Selling good things, why wouldn't you sell good things? Right? But replacing them is real. So a few years ago, I thought, I'm sick to death of just selling the good things. I want to have a little collection. So I thought, I'm going to have a little collection. That'll be great. It can be my pension fund. How exciting. So I got the Hogarth Press Wasteland inscribed by Eliot to Wyndham Lewis. I got Eliot's poems of 1920, first book of poems published in America, inscribed to Virginia Woolf. I got a first edition of Ulysses inscribed to one of the women who helped him type it up. I got D.H. Lawrence's own copy of The Rainbow. I got Hemingway's first book inscribed to Edward J. O'Brien, who more or less discovered Hemingway. And I'm looking at these books and I'm so happy, and I look at them and I show them to people, and then I look at them less and I show them to less people, and then they just sit there on the shelf. And somebody comes in and says to me, you've got that copy of the Hogarth Press Wasteland inscribed to Wyndham Lewis, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, I know where you bought that. I said, yeah, it was from a catalog. He said, I know how much you paid for it. Yeah, that would be £17,000. That was a very serious bargain. He said, so how much to me? I said, I don't want to sell it. It's in my collection. It's one of the defining things about myself now. He said, stop talking rubbish. How much is it to me? I said, £100,000. He said, fine, I'll write you a check. My collection of really good books now consists of one book, and I can't find a buyer for it, and if I could, I'd sell it. The fact of the matter is, once you're a dealer and you're not a rich person, the conditions under which you buy more books are that you sell the books that you like, and there's... You kept anything?
Rick's habit now is escalating to this improbable dimension. I mean, he runs the most exclusive book bordello imaginable.
People come in and they look at it, and there's only a tiny number, like 200 or 300 books, and they say in a very accusing way, is this a bookshop?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Bordello is not a term I've ever used. And then they look again and they say, you make a living out of this? And I say, yeah.
But Rick's shop, from Lyme Regis to Chocolate Square to Pyebull Yard and now to Bathurst Mews, it gets smaller and smaller, but the isotopic glow that comes off of it is, you know... I find myself a month ago going down the cobbled Mews way, or the only Mews with stables in central London, and I back on this bang on this black lacquered door, and the first thing I see as I step inside of the even smaller set of premises is a shelf of Dylan Thomas manuscripts. And I say, is this all? Because, well, I thought there must be somewhere here a little box that's got that lock of Sylvia Plath's hair. It does.
It's very interesting. If you have a lock of Sylvia Plath's hair, and I do, it's very hard to sell. It's very hard to sell all of it, but you can sell bits. And somebody actually said to me, I bought from Warren Plath, who was Sylvia's brother, the first cutting of Sylvia Plath's hair when she's 2.5 years old, and it has one of those cutesy little American hairdresser things saying, first cutting of baby's hair, S. Plath, age 2.5. And it would embarrass me to think I bought it separately, but I think I did. And so I had it, and then I have this little hair, and first thing I think is, you could clone Sylvia Plath with this hair. And if you had 200 or 300 of them, you could actually conquer the world. And so a guy comes to me and says, I want some of that Sylvia Plath hair. I don't need all that whole big tress of it. Can I just have a little bit? So I sold him a little bit for $500. That was a cool deal. And he said, what you ought to do is get little gold lockets made that say hair of Sylvia Plath and put one little bit in each one. And I said, that is such a humiliating idea. I couldn't do that. And he said, I don't see why it's more humiliating than having it as it is. It's just more commercial. I wrote a book once called Tolkien's Gown because I own J.R.R. Tolkien's Gown and I sold it in my first catalog. And when I sold it in the catalog, I got a phone call from Julian Barnes. And Julian rings and he says, Rick, it's Julian. Hello, how are you? He said, I'm interested in this Tolkien's Gown. I said, oh, I'm really sorry, it's sold. He said, don't be stupid, I don't want to buy it. I want to know, how much would you give me for Gertrude Stein's bra? And I said, I don't know, are you wearing it yourself? And he said, how about D.H. Lawrence's underpants? Pass, I said. What about, he said, James Joyce's smoking jacket? I said, ooh, now you're talking. And 2 days later in The Observer, there was a very satirical article about dealing in lit. How much did Cormac McCarthy's typewriter?
Cormac McCarthy's typewriter sold for $247,000 US. But then he had written most of the great works on it, and it was to raise money for the Santa Fe Writers' Center. But this is the area of realia, isn't it? This is the things associated with writers that are not necessarily printed
items. Have you had that kind of stuff?
I've had to pass opinions on it. I've not sold it. I mean, I can remember once having dinner with A.S. Byatt, and I brought along as discreetly as I could all the proofs of her published works to that date. And after we'd had a couple of drinks, she said, what's in the bag? And I thought, that's a relief. I don't have to raise the question. And I said, these are proofs of your wish. Will I incorporate some corrections? And I thought, this gets better and better. So we had a few more drinks and most of our main course. And she said, what's the strangest thing that a writer's ever asked you to do? And I thought, God, this is getting good. And I said, well, look, there is a writer, an Australian writer, who's asked me to find, by some means, any pen that had been used by George Orwell. As we sort of folded our napkins for the last time that night, she reached into her bag and undid a side pocket and gave me a pen. She said, first draft of Possession was done with that.
And gave it to you?
Gave it to me, yeah. So that's in a very carefully labelled box in my bureau. I think it was interesting that there was great excitement in Canberra in late 2006 when Patrick White's surviving manuscripts and effects were transferred to the National Library, that there was a radiant and totemic interest in the beret, the pen holder, and the glasses. And it was, I think, for institutions trying to sort of contextualise and present the creative effort, the process, these sort of material and related things add to the magic. And for a collector, I think, to have something from a favourite author, it's frequently part of that collecting instinct and process.
Well, you're lucky in your collectors, because one of the things I like is things associated with writers. That's right. And particularly
but
I like...
But you sold Joyce's death mask, for God's sake.
That would be true. I once, though, had Humphrey Ocean, who's a very fine painter, did a whole series of sketches of Philip Larkin, which led to the portrait of Larkin that's now in the National Portrait Gallery. And I bought from Humphrey all of those beautiful sketches of Larkin, gorgeous pencil things. So I got on the phone to my Larkin collectors, right? And this seems to me serious no-brainer. You love Philip Larkin. Here is a sketch for the portrait in the National Portrait Gallery. Ring up the first person. Boy, have I got good news for you. He said, no, thanks, I'll pass on that. I said, can we start again? You collect Philip Larkin, right? This because you read Philip Larkin, you like Philip Larkin a real lot, right? Yes. Images of Philip Larkin are not of any interest to you. No. I said, you're stupid. I'm going to call another Philip Larkin collector and you're going to be really sorry. I ranked 7 people and not one wanted it. And it's absolutely riveting to me. This may be the unimaginativeness of English collectors. I suspect it is in some ways. But by the end, I was livid. And I thought, I'm going to write an article about this. This will show them. And of course, I didn't. Not for lack of spleen, but for lack of energy. And I can never understand quite how literary people are merely literary. And yet it's often the case. But tell me this. Go back to Patrick White, because you had one of the 2 copies ever known of the Patrick White 13 poems.
Which he told me I would never find.
I did.
He told me.
And he told you. He didn't have one.
Well, I found his copy.
I bet you didn't give it back.
I found it, alas, posthumously.
Lucky you. Lucky you. One of the things that all of us dealers and all collectors adore is the notion of the black tulip, the thing which is more or less unobtainable. What's yours? If you could find one thing.
I'm still looking for Geoffrey Aspin's manuscript poems.
Tell everybody about that.
Sorry, Rick, it's a joke, Geoffrey Aspin.
It's from the Aspin papers.
No, I think what I'm looking for is probably the first draft of Ultramarine, Malcolm Lowry.
I owned part of that once.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I suppose I live in hope of finding a circulating script for The Return to Abyssinia, you know, Patrick White's commercially produced play, which was never actually committed to type beyond a stencil.
No one thing that kind of has burned itself into your consciousness and you think about. Of course, it would have been the Patrick White poems, and you got it.
I got it. Someone asked me this the other day, and I think when I like to imagine how blinding and electric that moment is when you discover it, it's something that I didn't know about that totally surprises me. When I got the call from Canberra to go and look at Patrick White's manuscripts, they were something that I had every reason to believe had been destroyed or didn't exist. And until I actually saw the piles of papers, thought that I was being subjected to a very complicated and cruel joke. But when you actually see them, fabulous. So I suppose I like to believe that something exists that no one knows exists or is thought not to exist.
That's the thing that...
Orwell's anti-war pamphlet.
That's rubbish compared to my one. James Joyce is 11 years old, right? Very precocious.
Brilliant career.
Kid. Actually very good at sports. Nobody knows that. Anyway, he's home holiday and Parnell has died. And his father, John Joyce, who's a great supporter of Parnell, is in an absolute rage. And by an odd process of osmosis and transmission, which is quite unhealthy in a way, this 11-year-old boy picks up his father's anger about the death of Parnell and writes a poem. And it's not clear what the title of the poem at the time is, though it comes to be known as Et Tu Healy and is A1, that is the first separate publication by James Joyce in the bibliography of James Joyce. The proud father says, oh my God, look at that poem my boy has written, and does what all of us parents would do, is runs down to the local printer and has, I don't know, 20 or 30 copies done as a single-page broadside. Stanislaus Joyce, who's the brother, remembers what they looked like and even remembered 4 or 6 of the lines. And no copy survives. Nobody's seen one for 80 years. John Joyce said, yeah, of course I paid for it. Didn't I pay for it? Didn't I even send a copy to the Pope? So I've written the Pope, dear Pope. Somewhere in the Vatican Library, you may see a poem by James Joyce. Could you let me know? Nothing, everybody's looked, Richard Ullman looked. To me, it's the ultimate literary black tulip. And I have this kind of fantasy that one day I'll go on TV, on RTE in Ireland, and hold up a check for $1 million US and say, anybody who can find me Annette Toohey, I will pay $1 million US for, which will get every forger in Ireland working. And I thought to myself, I think the reason I don't do this is because it's the kind of object which is better lost than found. Because when you find it, you're going to get a crumpled, rather dirty, soiled, foxed bit of paper with a very indifferent poem on it. And what's it going to be? It's going to lose all the numinosity of absence. And what you're going to have is a scrappy bit of paper by a kid.
Well, you're talking post-coitum now, aren't you?
after literary discovery, l'homme est triste.
Yeah.
And having said that, I'd still like to have it a real lot, because aside from the fact that if I made $1 million, if I paid $1 million, I know where I could get two, and that would be very agreeable, it somehow would fill a gap, not merely in Joyce studies and in bibliography and in the rare book world, but somehow something would be there where it hadn't been there before. And that's, go right back to the animating thing about the treasure hunt. That's what makes Nicholas work. That's what makes me work. That's what makes us have fun. Anyway, thank you all.
Rick Jacoski there, a rare bookseller based in London. And he's a rare, rare bookseller too, isn't he? He's published two books, Tolkien's Gown and Other Stories of Great Authors and Rare Books, and a memoir of his life as a collector called Outside of a Dog, Heard Before on First Person. And he was speaking with Nicholas Pounder, and Nicholas Pounder's Rare Books is based in Sydney.